This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Digital Audio Health by Cymatrax.
Welcome to the Rhonda Grant Show with your host, Rhonda Grant. If you believe that there is more to life than what you see right now, and you want to find out more, listen in as her guests share their journey and their extraordinary experiences. Now, here is your host, Rhonda Grant.
Welcome to the Rhonda Grant Show. Sometimes the universe has a way of placing people or obstacles in your path to help guide and direct you on your mission. Listen in as we discover the path my guest has traveled. Has he been inspired by a calling, crafted his journey, or a bit of both? I invite you to embrace the conversation and to use it to help you to recognize if this is happening in your life. Our guest today is Joseph McGuire, who is a facial profiler, body language expert, and author. Joseph has developed his skills, understanding, and awareness over the past 40 years and brings a spirit of curiosity to all his engagements. His intention is always to leave others feeling better about themselves for having met him and better equipped to create exceptional relationships in all areas of their life. Welcome to the Rhonda Grant Show, Joseph.
Oh, thank you, Rhonda. I'm honored to be here.
Well, it's so nice to have you on the show. You are originally from Ireland, and I wondered if you could let our audience know a little bit about your background, what it was like for you growing up in Ireland and what you studied when you were there.
Sure. Well, I am Irish. I was born here. I'm back living here, but I was away for 8 years, and I will live in other countries in the future. But I grew up in what I would describe as a very monoculture, monochrome country, very, very conservative Irish Catholic background. And that was the general culture at the time. I basically just went through the normal schooling process here, which for us would be national school, primary school, secondary school, which would be the equivalent of your middle school, high school, etc. in the US. I didn't go to university. I went into a job shortly after mm-hmm. leaving school. I really didn't know what I wanted to do or what I wanted to be. I just knew I didn't see anything in the world around me that fitted. I'd always felt different from early childhood. Like nothing in the world that I was seeing around me really made sense.
Yes.
So I didn't have a clear direction, but it was, I was always a voracious reader. It was one of the great gifts my parents gave me, that they had a love of reading. They introduced me to the local library as soon as I could read. So I was borrowing any and every book I could get my hands on and reading anything and everything. But I gravitated, I guess, particularly towards books around people who were different, people who were involved in mysticism or had different historical lives, or had in some cases had, how can I put it, who were philosophers or had in some cases developed their own very individualistic approach to life. Sometimes that was a positive life and sometimes it wasn't, but I just read anything and everything. And it was really when the job I was working in, which was then a record and tape distribution company, which ages me because back in the original days of vinyl and 4-track and 8-track and all of that.
The old 8-track.
Yes, absolutely. I do remember them. And it was only when that job closed and I was made redundant and I had the money, I was able to leave Ireland and do something I'd wanted to do for many years, which was to go to Israel and spend time on a kibbutz. I'd known various people who'd done it. And I'd, mm-hmm. as part of my reading, I loved history. And I
and what was that? What was that, Joseph?
What
you said a word. You said a word there that I didn't pick up. There, you went to
kibbutz.
Okay.
Kibbutz. Yes. And when in terms of the process of the founding of the state of Israel, there were two. What basically happened was that groups of Jews, and this was obviously before they became Israelis, got together and they formed two. They bought parcels of land from the local the Arabs. And what they formed two different kinds of settlement. One was called a moshav, which is where people could start their own business, etc., and earn their money, keep it for themselves. And then the kibbutz was more a collectivist, I guess what you would call a socialist kind of idea, where there were various businesses on the kibbutz, but everything was put into the collective pot, so to make sure everybody was fed, clothed, etc. Collective education for the children, etc.
Right.
And both types of community would have volunteers coming from different countries to spend time there, work there, etc. And as I say, I knew various people who'd been to Israel to spend time in a kibbutz. I'd read a lot about the history of the founding of the state of Israel, and it resonated with me because growing up in Ireland, I read a lot of Irish history, and Ireland had been occupied for 800 years. So I had this sense of the underdog,
okay,
and people who were repressed and colonized. And so I associated that with the founding of Israel, particularly after the Holocaust, etc. And so that drew me to Israel. And it was in Israel that I was introduced to people of so many different cultures. As I said, I came from a very monocultural country. Mm-hmm. And Ireland, for all of the mythology about it being this green and pleasant land, can be very grey, and there can be a lack of sunshine. So to be in a place where there was glorious sunshine, the colors were changing every day, and the mix of cultures just opened me in a whole different way to realizing there's a whole different, literally a whole different world out there, but in so many different dimensions.
Mm-hmm. And so what did you actually do while you were there?
It was hard physical labor, but it was great fun. Most of the time I worked in what were the banana fields, where what we would refer to as a bunch of bananas, which might be five or six bananas together, they referred to as a hand. And what they referred to as a bunch was the whole series on a big thick branch. So mm-hmm. we would be working in the banana fields for sometimes 8 to 10 hours a day, and you could be, and each bunch as we called it could be anywhere between 25 and 50 kilos, and you were just hauling them, loading them onto wagons all day. Mm-hmm. Five, six days a week. So it was hard physical labor, but I was very fortunate in that I worked with great people where we had a lot of fun, a lot of laughter, and we just enjoyed the experience. So and we had a lot of free time as well. So I was what, 23 at the time. So it was just a wonderful adventure.
Mm-hmm. And how long did you stay there?
I stayed there for just under 6 months. Mm-hmm. I realized at a certain point it was time to go. And that was when I moved from Israel to London. And London was where my real studies began, because that was where I started to learn about reading faces. That was where I trained initially as a shiatsu practitioner. But when I was introduced to reading faces, like I was introduced to it as a diagnostic tool, one of the diagnostic tools used in traditional Oriental medicine. But I had been reading people since I was a small child. I'd been reading body language, etc. I could tell a lot about people's character just from observing them. Mm-hmm. And so when I was introduced to face reading, and the Chinese perspective was always that the mind and the body are one inseparable unit, this was just like, I'm home. Now I've found something that makes so much sense to me that I can at least begin to explain what it is I do, what the knowledge I have, the understanding I have. And I could use facial diagnosis as a tool for explaining it, even though it, strictly speaking, wasn't actually what I was doing. But it gave me a structure to explain things to people.
Children, there are some children when they're growing up is that's what they pay attention to. And they know if mom or dad is angry based on what they pick up, how they walk, their vibrational frequency as well, right?
Yeah, ultimately, it is all about vibrational frequency. That's like we talk, I can talk about the visual signs, but the reality is for every one of us, no matter what our culture is, no matter whether we're male, female, or otherwise, because obviously there are various genders these days, but our whole body is an antenna, and the whole body is continually transmitting and receiving. Most people aren't conscious of it, but our body is picking up vibrations from people and places. And when we allow ourselves to be conscious of it, when we pay our attention to what our body is telling us, like we talk about things like gut feeling, for example, but most people aren't attuned to it and then will often second guess themselves when they do get a gut feeling. But when we do pay attention to things like gut feeling, then there's so much information available to us that actually helps prepare us to engage more effectively with other people.
Very contemplative. Yes, I mean, there's a lot of people who are not in touch with themselves and so have a hard time getting in touch with other people, or they become reflective of what other people are doing. Like if people are angry with them, then they elevate and they're angry back. So a lot of people don't have control of their vibrational frequency because they don't have an understanding how their energy affects other people. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, we don't learn this as children. We should be learning this. And I use should is one of those words I use very seldom, but it is it's a very potent word, and it can impact on people in different ways. But these are things we should be learning. We should be learning body awareness. We should be learning meditation. We should be learning self-awareness, how to manage our emotions, how to engage more effectively, how to communicate, how to present ourselves. We should be learning all these things as children, because the damage that has been inflicted, I'll use that word selectively, but the damage that has been inflicted on so many people because we haven't learned that. And there's been so many generations where people have been passing their own wounds on to their children, their grandchildren, etc. So it behoves any of us who have at least some degree of awareness of these things to share that awareness, to share the skills we have to help people present and communicate and engage much more effectively, and to begin, to begin a healing process, really, but to also transcend the beginning of the healing process, because I may be going slightly off tangent here. But,
no, this is good. I love it.
One of the things I've learned over the years, because I worked as a therapist for 30 years.
Okay.
And one of the things, and a lot of my clients, my patients, were therapists from various different backgrounds. And one of the things I have learned over the years is that many therapists haven't really mastered these things or haven't really taken them on in many respects. And they often keep their clients and their patients going around, as it were, on a treadmill, rather than helping them to transform and to become more fully who they're capable of being, because we're all capable of being more. However, whatever state we're in, whatever level of awareness we've attained, we're all capable of more. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, so many of us get stuck at way below. What we're really capable of achieving and attaining and sharing.
Mm-hmm. And that makes me think about Dr. Joel Bryant. And I've interviewed him a couple of times on the podcast. Our listeners will know this. And he, one of his favorite sayings he has is, we humans have the capacity for immensity. And I just love that. There's a lot of people who have had trauma in their life that may not realize that that trauma is affecting their whole life, their relationships with everybody all the way down the line. And even if they do recognize it, they may not have the bravery to face that again in order to heal from it, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. I know in my own case, a lot of my trauma was actually pre-birth, because my mother had various traumas in her own life. And also then while she was pregnant with me, my father was seriously ill and it was expected that he would die. So it was like I can only barely begin to imagine how stressful that time was for my mother.
Right.
So obviously I was in the womb, so I was taking in all of her emotions. And it was only many years later I actually learned that was my experience, and then begin to deal with it. But growing up, I carried that without being conscious of it, but I grew up with very little confidence and a lot of anger. And no idea where it came from. So I was probably well into my 30s when I began to be aware of it and began to start addressing it. But I've certainly, again, when I was working as a therapist, I came across many people who had been traumatized. And some of what I like, two of the modalities I worked with were hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
When I would put my hands on somebody, they may have made an appointment for a back problem or migraine or whatever it was. But
right.
Once I put my hand on them, I would know what was really going on in their life. And not the intimate details, but I would know instantly whether they'd been like traumatized. And if they had been traumatized, what kind of trauma it was. And in many cases, obviously, I had to be very careful and very diplomatic in how I broached the topic, because in many cases, they weren't aware of it. And then in some cases, and I found this actually even with some hugely experienced and hugely qualified therapists who came to me for treatment, that they weren't, not only were they not aware, but when they became aware, they weren't ready to address their own stuff either.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't force that on anybody. We have to approach it in a way that's gentle, kind, respectful, loving, but also very clear.
Mm-hmm.
How we communicate that with people.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of the, how I understand it, is a lot of the aches and pains that we feel in our body is from our past.
Absolutely, absolutely. Particularly the ones that are deep-seated and that stay there for any great length of time. It's like one of my sayings, I guess, is that the body is a metaphor for how we are, and the body is a great teacher. The body teaches us pretty much anything we need to know about ourselves if we allow ourselves to tune into it. When I worked as a therapist,
mm-hmm.
I used to do a lot of dialogue with the body. I initially started working with, like, I don't know if you've come across the animal totems.
Oh, please tell. Beautiful
work. Basically, it's a long time since I worked with it, so I'm probably not describing it with great accuracy. But the basic idea is that in the Eastern tradition, we have seven centers, seven chakras.
Yes.
And we could describe as each of those chakras as a point on the totem pole.
Okay.
And what we can do is we can start pretty much anywhere on any of those seven points, depending on where the person feels the particular discomfort.
Okay.
And we can ask them to tune into that place and bring their attention into it. And then we can build it up. Like I also brought in aspects of NLP. I know, like,
yes,
a previous guest, Stuart, was talking about NLP, but mm-hmm. I always to allow the dialogue to build and be effective, I would ask them to tune into that. What was the feeling in the place I was holding into, and I brought their attention into. If it had a color, what color would it be? If it had a voice, what kind of voice would it speak with? What tone of voice? And then if it were a creature, what kind of creature would it be? And the creature could be a bear, it could be a tiny mouse, mm-hmm. Depending on what was going on for the person. And right. over a period of session, you build up a relationship with the creature, whichever creature it was. And then over a period of sessions, you'd gradually work your way through the seven chakras, and each one would have a creature. And it could be like one, so you could have a mouse in one, you could have a bear in the next one, and gradually you'd build up a communication between them. And the process is designed to create alignment so that they're all seven centers are working together in harmony, and they're working to support the individual, to encourage the individual, to empower the individual, rather than so often people feeling disempowered or disconnected, and bringing them into a place of awareness from deep inside themselves. Because really what we're doing is we're connecting them with their deep subconscious, and we're not telling them what they should be doing. We're allowing them to discover it from deep within themselves. So that's what that approach is about. And it's helping people to resolve, in many cases, resolve deep trauma in a very gentle, non-intrusive way.
Mm-hmm. And so does this mean that they do not have to go back and revisit that trauma one more time? Is it that type of thing?
That's the ideal. That's the
right.
ideal.
That's the ideal.
It'll vary from person to person. And it's sometimes the release is like just instantaneous. Mm-hmm. Because it's the point of awareness that really matters. And the awareness, and it's bringing them into the awareness that what happened. It's not still happening. And it's that feeling or that thinking that it's still happening is where we get stuck. That I'm still carrying that old, the burden of that pain. And it's not that we're ignoring the fact that something, in many cases, something horrendous happened that should never have happened. It's not disrespecting that memory or the experience in any way. It's not disavowing the experience. It's recognizing, yes, it happened, mm-hmm. but you're no longer that same person. Mm-hmm. Physically, your cells have changed, but the cells have held on to the memory. But with new awareness, you can move forward into your life in a way that has you feeling very empowered rather than disempowered.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that is very interesting. And I don't think that people realize that these types of traumas, whether small or big, that they do live in our cells.
Absolutely, they do, yes. And like if you look at the work of Dr. Gabor Mate, for example,
yes.
he has shown that, and the research he quotes, the research he has studied, has demonstrated that time and time and time again. Unfortunately, most doctors, I'll use the term, it's a broad term, whether it's doctors of general mm-hmm. medicine or doctors of psychiatry or specialists, simply too busy to read a lot of the research. They do have very busy schedules, very busy lives, and it would be impossible for them to read all the research that's out there.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, and it has been clinically proven time and time again, that our cells hold not always necessarily the memory in a conscious sense, because memory can be distorted, but hold the impact of the trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the impact as much as the memory that we're looking to change. In fact, even more than the memory.
And when you say even more than the memory.
Yeah, because we can change, like we can use techniques, we can use reverting back to your former guest, Stuart, who's a great friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can use hypnotherapy, you can use various NLP techniques to, what's the term? I think the term is to distort memory. memory can be distorted anyway. Like we don't sure. necessarily remember things as they actually happened, but we can change our understanding or our perception of the memory. That's relatively easy. But unless we change the impact of whatever the trauma was, people will tend to revert back. As you know, that's one of the questions you were asking a few moments ago. People will often turn to revert back into the pattern, the behavior pattern, the belief pattern, the actions that follow from fact that, oh yeah, I'm still holding that trauma, even if it's not that they're consciously holding it.
Mm-hmm. Well, boy, what a wonderful therapy that you're able to do for people, because we don't get out of this world by not having a car accident. All sorts of things can happen to us in our lives, even past the time where we leave our parents, where what they went through and how they've built, how they respond to things, which is passed on. We don't realize it's passed on, but it is passed on unless you heal from that type of situation. But it's other things that cause trauma. And even as you said, before you were even born, you had trauma in the womb because based on what your mom was going through at the time.
Absolutely. Yes. And that was one of the great joys when I was working as a therapist. One of the modalities I worked with was craniosacral therapy, which yes. is a particularly gentle form of therapy. And it allowed me to work with people of all ages, but I especially loved working with young babies. And when babies came, so often they were carrying trauma, okay. whether it was from time in embryo or whether it was the birth itself or something happened after the birth. So to be able to work with babies and release that trauma and experience the baby going from being really, really angry, really, really upset, mm-hmm. or really physically almost knotted up, to just, you could see them, the body opening up almost. You could often see their arms just spreading out, and then they would take a big, you could actually hear them breathing out like a massive sigh. And then they would often start humming. And to know that the baby was suddenly released whatever it was they were holding. And yeah. then you could see the relief in the parents and the difference, the impact that made on the family, because it eased so much stress on the parents and in the family as well. Mm-hmm. So it had those lovely ripples that spread out. So and that like to work with babies was just such a privilege, such a blessing.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I hope the listening audience felt what I felt when you were talking about that, because I had goosebumps all over my body that was possible to heal a baby from the trauma, from womb trauma. What other things does cranial work help?
Gosh, again, I'm no longer working as a therapist.
Okay, you're not working. Okay.
So it's like at a certain point, like back in 2015 or thereabouts,
yeah.
my body reached a point where it said no more.
That's it.
Because I had a lot of unresolved stuff of my own. That was, mm-hmm. And also in the last few years of working as a therapist, I got a reputation for being very good at deep tissue work.
Okay, and yes.
So as some of the people I was working on, I might as well have been trying to massage a table.
Oh,
really? Like their muscles were so taut. But again,
yeah, I don't mean to laugh, but people yeah. are really bottled up, right?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And then I was picking that up, and I was absorbing that through my hands when I was working on them. So at a certain point, my body just said, "Enough, can't do this anymore."
Right on. Okay, why don't we move on then mm-hmm. to talking about the next, one of the things that you studied, I'm not sure if it was the next thing, but is facial.
Yeah, well, that goes back
identification.
To...
Identification.
Absolutely, that goes back, like when I was living, when I moved to London from Israel, that was when I I was introduced to facial diagnosis. So I've actually been working for many years. I was teaching it to healthcare professionals.
Okay.
Because I gave a lot of seminars and workshops. Initially, I trained in London for like 4.5 years. Then I moved to Hamburg in the north of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So I was teaching people there, then moved back to Ireland and was teaching it here. And initially I was teaching it as a diagnostic tool, but I was more and more fascinated by going back to that oriental idea, that the mind and the body are one inseparable unit.
Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing the person revealed in the face, their personality, their behavior style, their character, stress mm-hmm. triggers and responses, and so much more. And that mm-hmm. was much more fascinating to me ultimately than the diagnostic side. So I was bringing in more about the communication and relationship and personality aspects into what I was teaching. So it was when I had to stop working as a therapist, the one thing I was trained to do was teach people to read faces. And I knew that a number of people in the US in particular had been working with it in a business and corporate setting, a legal setting as well. So I road tested it here with, invited business audiences, and then developed a model for bringing it into business here. And that's what I've been particularly doing. But more and more now, it's kind of, I don't know whether to use the term evolve or revert it, but it has kind of, as I've emerged more fully, I guess, as myself, and opened up more fully to life, and more and more what I'm about now is helping people create exceptional relationships, starting from the inside out, based around trust, respect, and kindness.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So with the facial diagnostic, the police and the FBI, they also use this. And can you talk to that?
Yeah, absolutely. The criminal detection agencies of various kinds have mm-hmm. used particularly body language, micro expressions, facial expressions, face reading as a means of helping them to read the behavior patterns of whether actual criminals or suspected criminals, and to develop the most ideal and effective ways to communicate with people. And those of us who grew up watching movies and TV and watching like detective movies, etc., on screen,
mm-hmm.
we tended to see this image of people being thrown up against walls and punched and threatened and all of that. But the reality is the most effective people doing investigation and interrogation were actually about people who use these skills to develop empathy and trust and respect, and to develop conversational relationships with whether it was criminals or suspects, so that the criminal developed a sense of ease and was more willing to reveal the information that the investigators needed. So that was such a pleasant surprise for me to realize that so mm-hmm. many of the best investigators and interrogators were about building empathy, trust, and respect rather than trying to force anything to happen.
Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating, absolutely fascinating, Joseph. You're listening to The Rhonda Grant Show right now, whose podcast has been treated with digital audio health by my sponsor, Symetrex. And today we're speaking with Joseph McGuire. Joseph, let people know how they may reach out and contact you.
Sure. Thank you, Rhonda. Yes, I'm most easily reached on LinkedIn. So LinkedIn is where I'm most active. I do have a profile. Just look me up as Joseph McGuire. That's McGuire. I do have a website, which is clearsightcommunications.com, mm-hmm. but I'm less active there. It does need updating. You will find me on, I do have a Facebook page under ClearSight Communications, but really LinkedIn is the best way to reach me.
Wonderful. Thank you. What extraordinary discovery have you found in your life?
I guess the big one, and it's still unfolding, is that life is actually a magical journey. And I guess on some level, I've always known it, but it's taken me a long time to open to that, to open to, like, we make so many discoveries in life, and we're either open or we're not. But one of the things I came across more recent years was the HeartMath Institute. And the HeartMath Institute have clinically proven that we have three brains, the one in the head that we were more conscious of, but we also have a brain in the gut and a brain in the heart.
Yes.
And there's actually, they've measured it that there are more messages going up from the brain in the gut and the brain in the heart to the head than vice versa.
Yeah.
So it's been, the more I've listened to the heart, and traditionally we've associated the heart with love and, love and romance, etc. But the heart is the center of joy and loving awareness. It's the, in the Chinese system, they use the word shen, and shen is life spirit, vitality, joy of living. And when we open to our hearts and we begin to experience that and transmit it and communicate it and share it, then we experience the fact that even the simplest experience can be actually magical, because it is actually quite miraculous that any of us are here. When you think about the potential for, at the time of conception, etc.
Oh, yes. It's unbelievable that we're actually, you and I are here.
Yeah.
Because of what happened in order for the egg to be fertilized, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so there's a common phrase that people say, and I really contemplated on it. It's called get out of your own way. And people just, they say it, but I really don't think that people understand what that means. And for me, and let me know what your feelings are around it, is that get the brain out of it and just go with the heart, go with the gut feeling. And that's how you get out of your own way, because your brain will tell you all day long not to do something. Or to do something you shouldn't be doing, right? Like watching television when you should be doing something else.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so much of that part of our processing, our habits, our conditioning is based around survival. And survival sort of intimates that things should remain the same, because change could be dangerous. So once we realize that and can step back from it, we realize, I'm not my conditioning. I'm not this image of who and what and how I thought I was or how I thought I should be. I have choice here. And it's like the Carl Jung saying, I'm not what happened to me, I'm what I choose to become. And realizing we have so much choice in terms of how we can be in the world, even who we can be. Now, I obviously recommend being very, very clear about our values. But in terms of that we often have so many illusions about our personality and the type of person we are, and we will often behave according to those illusions, and we'll behave out of habit rather than out of present time awareness. This is me now. I have choice. I have fresh choice as to how I can be in this situation here. And that's part of the magic. That's part of where life just becomes magical, to realize I don't have to behave however I behave. And even if it was a similar situation, that I behaved in a particular way in the past, it does not mean I have to behave in any kind of similar way now. I have choice. But it's that moment of awareness that allows us to, I'm free to choose, which is quite beautiful.
Because lots of times we feel like a ping pong, right?
Yeah. Oh gosh, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's the game you'll see in arcades with the flippers, where you're flipping a ball. I don't know the name of it either because I don't play it,
but it's pinball or something.
Pinball, exactly, that's the one, pinball machine. Yeah, for you know, at different times in my life, I felt like I was in a pinball machine, just being bounced around.
Yeah, and for people that don't realize that you don't have to feel like that. If you're feeling like that, there you have choices to stop that, to stop a conversation with somebody that's not benefiting you or raising your anxiety. You just stop responding to that person. Just stop responding.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's to find whatever is the next first step to changing it.
Exactly.
Because I know many people's, like, I wouldn't be facetious, many people are in incredibly difficult circumstances where it may not be possible to change, mm-hmm. you know, a huge amount at one time. Mm-hmm. But it's to find, if change is necessary, what is the next best first step I can take?
Right.
And then what's the next one after that?
And what's the next one after that? Yes. Yeah. Do you feel that you've been called, Joseph? To your journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it hasn't always been a straightforward journey by any means.
No.
But it becomes clearer, not so much necessarily in the intellectual sense, but in the sense of, I guess, going back to that thing, the heart opening to joy and wonder and magic, and simply being willing to step into that and embrace that, whatever that may mean. And I would never attempt to predict the future. Like, you know, I might have goals and intentions and, you know, people talk about New Year resolutions and all of that, but I never want those to be like fixed in stone, that it mm-hmm. has to be this or it has to be that, mm-hmm. because for me personally, there has to be a willingness to flow forward, to adapt, to adjust.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Yes. Simple answer to the question. Yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because some people spend a lot of their life protecting themselves, which is protecting their heart. And it's actually can be painful when you allow those barriers to start coming down, when you can get in touch with the true essence of who you really are.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Because so often we've built walls around the heart, and it can feel like we're being disloyal to the pain.
Oh,
which is a curious phenomenon, but it is actually well known in therapeutic circles. Mm-hmm. We feel a sense of loyalty to the pain. It almost becomes, the pain is part of our identity. Which is,
oh yes,
it sounds weird, but it is mm-hmm. actually the case for so many people, and that this pain is part of what has made them who they are. And in a sense, yes, maybe, but it's the learning and the stepping forward from the experience rather than the experience itself.
Mm-hmm. Because people, that's part of their story. And if they let go of part of their story, then they may feel that they're letting go of part of their identity. Is this correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But to realize that we're not our story. The story is part of our experience, mm-hmm. but it's not the identity. And, mm-hmm. and the story can be what limits us.
Oh, yes.
And again, that was one of the things I guess I learned from my mentor in particular.
Yes.
That the story is information.
Mm-hmm.
And how we choose to use the information is up to us, but it's not our identity.
Mm-hmm. But there are people who take it on as their identity.
Oh gosh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I came across that again when I was working as a therapist. There were people who mm-hmm. came to me who were leaders in organizations to do with different ailments.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like the ailment was their badge of identity.
Oh, yes.
And I experienced it so often, they did not really want any significant change because then they would lose their identity. Being the leader of the organization who had this condition gave them prominence, gave them notice, gave them attention. In some cases, gave them a significant salary.
Oh, yes, so, I see. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they became very, like, you can understand the logic.
Mm-hmm, but yeah.
Equally, I could see that they were significantly limiting themselves by that. But then, mm-hmm. People are free to make those choices.
Mm-hmm. Because sometimes keeping that and having those types of things as your identity actually makes you ill.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
You don't understand why you can't get out of bed or you're depressed or whatever. We don't really take our lives and dissect it and figure out why we don't feel well. Right. Yeah. We just keep on going and say, that is separate from my life. It has nothing to do with what I'm doing or anything I'm holding inside right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, so much of that goes back to that, the fact that very, very few of, if any of us, were taught any of that awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not as children, and in many cases, not as adults either.
No, it's the way our whole society is set up.
Yeah, yeah. And, we can look at reasons for that. There's no mm-hmm. money really when it comes down to it. There's no great money to be made in people being really well.
There's no money in that. There's happiness, but it's not lucrative.
No.
Right.
Which isn't to say that there can't be other models developed, but mm-hmm. that requires
exactly.
a shift in awareness.
Mm-hmm. And right now there is a whole shift in human consciousness. And so this might be where the future is actually going.
One would hope, absolutely.
One would hope.
Yeah. And again, there's a responsibility on those of us who have whatever degree of awareness we have
mm-hmm.
to share that and to be open to realizing that, we have our limitations and we all can grow so much more.
Oh, but yes.
None of us is the finished article in that sense.
Yes, that's right. We have so much potential, so much potential. Thank you so much for being a guest on the Rhonda Grant Show, Joseph. It's just been so delightful, informing, and the topics that I'm totally interested in. I didn't even know I was interested in some of the topics until you brought them up. So thank you so much. It's been fascinating, and I've really enjoyed our time together.
Thank you, Ron. It's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Theme song for the Rhonda Grant Show is Sun on the Water, composed and performed by my friend John Park Wheeler. This is Rhonda Grant with the Rhonda Grant Show, author of Magical Forces Within, Extraordinary Discoveries in an Ordinary Life, inviting you to look for the magical forces within yourself today and every day.
Thanks for tuning in to the Rhonda Grant Show with your host, Rhonda Grant. If you would like to find out more information about Rhonda and her upcoming guests and the work that she does, go to her website, rhondagrantauthor.com. That's rhondagrantauthor.com.
Digital Audio Health by Simatracks.